Hey everybody, welcome to our KrausCast Elder Law Debrief. My name is Jim Wolverton. I am the Director of Legal Education here at Kraus Financial. With the Elder Law Debrief, you'll find the interactive agenda in your GoToWebinar menu. If you have attended one of these before, you'll know what's coming. If not, it's a very quick ride through the cases that, in my sole discretion, I decided were most important that came out between October of last year and February of this year. The goal for this is to get through as many cases as possible in 30 minutes. We've provided you the links to the cases in the interactive agenda, and then I added one that came out last week, and we included the PDF there. So the goal isn't for you to learn everything about the case. It's to pull out the highlights of the case. And then if you have any of these issues come up in your practice, you'll have that case available for you. So with that said, that's a warning that I do go very quickly through these cases, and we'll try to get through as many as we can in that half an hour. I did add a case, so I might go a little bit over, but we'll see how that goes. Those of you that are new to Kraus Financial, we are an attorney-led firm that provide asset preservation solutions for estate planning and elder law attorneys using primarily the Medicaid compliant annuity, funeral expense trusts, and long-term care insurance for your clients. So if you are in that business, we are here to help you in any way that we can. So with that, we'll start with the cases, and then we'll hop in to just a quick synopsis of some elder law news that is currently going on. So our first case is the matter of estate of Beck. This is, what is the future of wills? Is it on TikTok? And this comes from the Supreme Court of Montana. On July 11th of 2022, Jesse Beck sent Jason Beck, his brother, a phone video recording of himself in which Jesse stated, "I, Jesse Beck, if anything happens to me whatsoever, I give all of my possessions, everything, to Jason Beck, my brother. Christina Fontenot does not get one thing, not one thing." Whatever Christina did made him want to send his brother this video. Unfortunately, 4 days later, Jesse crashed his motorcycle, and as the responding officer was coming, the responding officer killed Jesse. So tragedy strikes. He survived only by his one child, Alexia. Alexia files was appointed the personal representative for Jesse's intestate estate, claiming there was no will. However, Jason, the brother, files a complaint seeking to intervene and petition for a formal probate based on that video recording as an enforceable will, which would make him sole devisee and be appointed as personal representative and remove Alexia as the personal representative. Alexia files an objection saying the video is not a will under Montana statute. District court order enters an order saying Jason was trying to probate a will under the statute, but the statute that he cited is writings intended as wills, and that statute permitted probate even if a document was executed in compliance with other statutory requirements as a document or writing added upon a document, but including video under that statute makes no sense. That's a step too far. It ruled that the statute does not allow a video to be considered as a document or writing upon a document that was intended as a will. So Jason's petition to probate Jesse's video recording was denied. And then he appeals that, and it gets all the way to the Supreme Court of Montana, which I think is very interesting in where our wills headed. They're headed to TikTok, I think. So Montana ultimately rules against that in this case, but it takes a while to get there. And I think we're expanding that definition every year that goes past. So basically what the court does, it reviews the relevant statutes regarding the formalities of will execution and writings intended as wills, and highlights that both statutes are focused on having proper documents. And that definition of documents is what's going to rule this case. Jason argues that the term documents or writing contrasted with language in the execution statute, but it establishes the legislature's intent to allow non-written documents such as video and audio recordings to also qualify as intended will. And then he points to dictionary definitions of electronic documents, which had been added to a lot of the document statutes through the UPC, the Uniform Probate Code, stating that they should be liberally construed and applied to promote its underlying purposes and policies. He argues this should include video recordings as documents to further purport for to further the purpose of honoring testamentary intent and promote justice. It was pretty clear what Jesse wanted in that video. So that was his testamentary purpose. So why wouldn't that be a will, is basically what Jason's arguing. Alexa come back and says, pretty simple argument, document's a document. And at the minimum, it must be capable of both being written upon and signed, and that the legislature did not state any intent to include video or audio recordings as valid testamentary instruments. The court looks to the Uniform Laws Commission, which has produced a Uniform Electronic Wills Act to bring estate planning into the digital age, but that act still requires a testator to make a will that is readable as text at the time the testator electronically signs a document, a signature, and two witnesses with electronic signature. Montana hasn't even adopted that statute. And then they further look around the country, but and no state has authorized a non-written video will or approved of such will has been made by any court applying the Uniform Probate Code. The statute's plain language and the structure and context clearly imply that a document is a physical paper or possibly a digital file on which words are produced and which would be capable of being signed and witnessed, thus not extending to video or audio recording. And here the video is neither written, signed, or witnessed by anyone or accompanied by documentation attempting to do those things. Montana statute and the UPC requires a will to be a document, and the court finds no clear basis to extend that definition to a video recording lacking any form of statutory authentication, even under a liberal construction of the provision, and Jason's petition was ruled to be properly denied. You can see where this is going, and it's going further and further into the digital era now that we've kind of opened that door off of written documents and onto electronic documents. There's arguments on both sides, but in Montana, at least, a video is a step too far. Okay, our next case is Scott v. Scott out of the Supreme Court of Alabama. It deals with a promissory note. If you're using promissory notes in your Medicaid planning, I have a vested interest that you stop doing that, but for many reasons, those can be attacked unless, obviously, you're in the state of New York. So Scott v. Scott, the Supreme Court of Alabama. Janetta is the administratrix of the estate of Willie Scott. And so Jimmy comes in and files a complaint against Janetta that says that Willie signed a promissory note to pay Jimmy $67,000 by March of 2020. Janetta countered by filing defenses that the note wasn't properly executed and should not be enforceable. Jimmy responds with an affidavit of his own and of two witnesses stating Willie executed the note, appeared to be competent at the time, did so voluntarily, and Willie expressed his understanding of its contents. Well, guess what Janetta does? She files her own affidavits. And she says there is a genuine issue of material fact whether Willie signed the note. And then she attaches her own affidavit and one from Vanessa Tyner. Janetta's affidavit states her late husband's name isn't signed on the promissory note, but it's printed, so it's not a signature. Promissory notes can get messy. Vanessa Tyner comes in and says she's worked with him for 30 years and that wasn't his signature, and then just drops a little nugget that mentions that he was also murdered in this affidavit. So use a Medicaid compliant annuity, don't use promissory notes. This is the reason why. After some procedural wrangling, Jimmy's awarded a summary judgment in his favor on this case, and Janetta files a motion to have that motion for summary judgment set aside. Janetta argues that summary judgment should be set aside because she also submitted affidavits that countered Jimmy's motion for summary judgment, and there is a genuine issue of material fact, and the court should not be determining the credibility of the witnesses at this phase. In its ruling in favor of summary judgment for Jimmy, the circuit court stated that Jimmy provided three affidavits from three witnesses who personally witnessed Willie sign the promissory note. And in response, Willie's estranged wife testifies the signature wasn't Willie's. The circuit court would not have made this decision that there was no genuine issue of material fact by determining that Jimmy's witnesses were credible and Janetta and her witnesses were not. And so it's well established that the court can't undertake credibility assessments in reviewing testimonial evidence submitted in favor and in opposition to a motion for summary judgment. Making such assessments is one of the key functions of a trial jury. Credibility determinations, the weighing of evidence, and the drawing of legitimate inferences from the facts are jury functions, not those of a judge. Whether he is ruling on a motion for summary judgment or for a directed verdict, the evidence of the non-movement is to be believed, and all justifiable inferences are to be drawn in their favor. Because Jimmy presented affidavits stating that the signature on the promissory note was Willie's, and Janetta presented contradictory affidavits stating that the signature on the promissory note was not Willie's, there was a genuine issue of material fact as to whether the signature on the promissory note was actually Willie's, and summary judgment is reversed, so that battle of affidavits can be done not in front of a judge on a motion for summary judgment. But again, using promissory notes can open the door to these types of battles. The estate of Nothnagel, I guess that's how you say that. This is a case out of Michigan. I think the headline for this one would be good-hearted lawyers only win on television. Here we have Marilyn Nothnagel. She died in 2020, New Year's Eve. Before her death, she was under a conservatorship with her daughter, Patricia Rogers, serving as conservator up until January of 2019. Then Brenda Miller, a professional fiduciary, was appointed as conservator until Marilyn passed away. For a period of time, Marilyn was receiving Medicaid benefits and living in a county-run nursing home, but she was determined ineligible for benefits, and then she moved into a different home and was paying privately for her care until she passed away. Once she passes away, Rogers files for an informal probate and was issued letters as personal representative. Well, the state Medicaid agency, DHHS, comes in and says, we have a proof of claim for those Medicaid services in the amount of $182,000. And the good attorney here, James Modrell, comes in and says, well, I have a statement of proof of claim for legal services for the conservator and helping them get qualified for Medicaid in the amount of $22,000 that hasn't been paid. So in June of 2022, Rogers, and this seems to be her pattern, she does stuff until it gets complicated, and then she comes in, and Miller comes in as a successor personal representative. So Miller comes in and says, okay, I figured out the estate settlement. We followed the schedule for payment. The Medicaid agency, as third creditor, is going to be compensated $181,000 and change, and then the attorney's not getting anything because there's no money left over. So the attorney files an objection because his legal services, he thinks, should be considered a higher priority than the Medicaid agent's claim per statute. Obviously, the Medicaid agent didn't agree and cited a different statute, claiming they were the ones that had priority to the money. During the hearing, the attorney states that he didn't collect his payment while she was alive because he knew she'd been disqualified for Medicaid and there was a concern that her funds would not outlast her. Good attorney, doing good things. He argues in his brief that as a court of equity, the court should consider that he purposefully held back on pursuing collection of his bills for legal fees to ensure that she would have sufficient funds for her care. What a great guy. But had his claim been made during her lifetime, he would have priority. The probate court says, attorney, we're going to figure out a way to get you that money. And I love this quote, so I'm going to read it. At the end of the day, the estate's not going to any family member of the decedent. Because the battle is it either all goes to the state of Michigan as reimbursement for Medicaid, or it gets divvied up with the bulk still going to the state, but $22,000 and change going to appellee for his attorney's fees. In this matter, the court views its role as one of equity. Ms. Brenda Miller testified that it appears that the appellee essentially sat on his attorney's fees out of concern for the protected individual, as he did not wish to deplete all of her funds. What a beautiful written opinion for that attorney doing well. And you can guess what the Medicaid agency did. Well, they appealed that, and here we are. Basically, what this comes down to is which statute governs. And so they cited two different statutes. One is for the statute that governs conservatorships. The other one is the priority and probate. The conservatorship statute provides a procedure for a claimant to follow when seeking payment on a claim against a protected individual or against the estate of that individual. And then the probate priority statute is here. And when we get to 1F, that's where the Medicaid estate recovery claim comes out, is under debts and taxes with priority under federal law. Not limited to medical assistance payments that are subject to adjustment or recovery under the estate recovery statute of 1396P. And then they felt that his claim was underneath the I, so it was a reduced claim in priority under all other claims. So they say that the agency's claim falls under F, whereas his falls under I. Rather, the priorities, the parties challenge whether the conservatorship statute could override the order of priority under the probate statute, such that the appellee's pre-death legal fees were properly compensated before the agency's medical assistance payments. And we conclude the probate court erred when it entered its order of allowance, providing that appellee's claim be paid pursuant to the conservatorship statute. The plain language reflects that it pertains to claims against a protected person during his or her lifetime, as opposed to the appropriate means of distributing the estate of protected persons after they've passed away. Appellee provided legal services to decedent's conservators regarding the Medicaid eligibility greater than 1 year prior to the death. However, the appellee failed to collect those fees until after the administration of the decedent's estate. Therefore, his claims are not the type contemplated under the statute. Well, while appellee advanced that as a court of equity, the probate court was permitted to consider the circumstances surrounding his delay in seeking compensation for his legal services, equitable courts are not exempt from following the plain language of a statute. Thus, appellee's conduct, while admirable, so the justices gave him that, remained subject to the priority provision delineated under the probate statute. The agency maintained a valid estate recovery claim, and pursuant to the probate statute, its claim was of higher priority than appellee's claim when determining the appropriate distribution of the estate. So, unfortunately, the good attorney here does not win, and the big meme Medicaid agency gets its estate recovery. Okay, Reich v. Reich is a case out of California. The headline here is, I like to think, it's all about the destination, not the journey, which might be a different philosophical approach than most of the people in California have. So on September of 2003, Thomas Reich created a revocable trust that stated that his ex-wife, his brother, and his nephew were to receive a total of $1.5 million in specific cash gifts, and then in this same trust created a separate trust, sub-trust, for his daughter and his granddaughter, Aaliyah, and to receive any residue of the trust upon his death. He also maintained an IRA and completed a beneficiary form designating Shannon and Leah's separate trust as equal beneficiaries. And you can imagine what happens next. He marries his longtime close acquaintance, Pamela, in November of 2020, and he dies a few months later. You can imagine what's going on there. He doesn't update his documents during the short marriage. His longtime close acquaintance was not named on the IRA as a beneficiary. So when he dies, the IRA had a balance of around $1.5 million, and the IRA was determined under California law, which is a community property state, so this case has a lot of that nuance in it, was determined to be Thomas's separate property. So this great longtime acquaintance files a petition and says, I'm an omitted spouse, and I want to share that estate. And she argues that the proceeds from the IRA were part of the estate because those proceeds had been marshaled through that revocable trust before they could get to Shannon and Leah's separate trust. So that's the journey that those IRA proceeds have to go through. Shannon disagrees, arguing the IRA proceeds pass directly to the trust and hence not through the main trust, that they fell outside of Thomas's estate for the purpose of calculating the omitted spouse's share. The trial court rules that IRA proceeds can sometimes be included in the decedent's estate, and that the IRA proceeds in this case would pass to the sub-trust of the trust and then essentially be paid to the actual trust. While that argument was going on, the party settled some of the case and Pamela receives over $188,000 for her seven-month marriage, but the fight continues over the IRA proceeds. Pamela then refiles her claims in a different procedure. The judge rules the IRA proceeds are not subject to the omitted spouse's share as non-probate assets and the other non-probate assets, and the ruling was not controlling. So Pamela appeals, and the cases are all consolidated into this one. So we got to figure out where those IRA proceeds are going. It is the policy of California that spouses are to provide for one another, and a person's failure to provide for their surviving spouse and their testamentary instruments is strongly disfavored and thus generally presumed to be the product of oversight, accident, mistake, or unexpected change of condition rather than intent. California law has mandated a partial revocation of any will or trust by operation of law in order to provide the omitted spouse a share of the decedent's estate while simultaneously trying to preserve as much as the decedent's premarital estate plan as feasible. Doing a trust administration in California sounds very complicated. The probate code states that an omitted spouse is entitled to one half of the decedent's community and quasi-community property, and that a share of the decedent's separate property equal in value to what the omitted spouse would have received had the decedent died intestate. Try to figure that out when you're advising a trustee. The omitted spouse's share is to be drawn first from any portion of the decedent's estate, not dispersed of by will or trust, but if that's not sufficient, then the omitted spouse's share is to be taken from all beneficiaries of the decedent's testamentary instruments. My goodness. For the purposes of this case, the estate includes the decedent's probate estate and all property held in or passing by any revocable trust that becomes irrevocable on the death of the decedent. IRA proceeds are not part of the probate estate and are specifically named as non-probate transfers in the code, and California law has long treated them as such. However, although IRA proceeds can sometimes pass through a trust that becomes irrevocable upon death, such as when the designated beneficiary of the IRA is the decedent's trust. However, the IRA proceeds in this case never became part of the revocable trust for purposes of calculating Pamela's omitted spouse's share. Pamela's argument that the IRA proceeds did pass through the trust and are part of the trust because the beneficiaries of the proceeds are the subtrust of the main trust were created by that trust is rejected. So that argument didn't work. I like this language. We see no reason why Thomas's decision to kill two birds with one stone by creating the separate trust in the trust document itself should lead to a different result when the IRA proceeds are still passing directly from the IRA to those separate trusts, and importantly, not through the trust, nor does it matter that the beneficiaries are the separate trust for Shannon and Leah rather than them as individuals. The proceeds are not passing through the revocable trust. She makes additional similar arguments, and the court rejects all of those for the journey of those IRA proceeds directly to the subtrust rather than having to go through the revocable trust and be subject to all the crazy California probate rules for omitted spouses. Okay, last case. This is one I added from New Jersey. It came out last week. That's why it's not part of the agenda. IM versus the Division of Medical Assistance and Health Services. And my headline for this one is Accountants Rule the World. So here we have the appellant who's living in an assisted living facility and applies for community-based Medicaid. Part of the application process for community-based Medicaid in New Jersey was to provide the separate cost of her medical costs separate from the cost of room and board. When the county Medicaid worker reached out to the assisted living facility, she was provided information that the medical costs were only $75 per day of the full assisted living daily charge. So their application was denied because the appellant's monthly income was almost $9,000, and that was way over the amount to cover the $75 per day for just the medical costs, which would have equaled around $2,500 per month. So she had way too much income. So after the denial, the applicant requested an itemized billing from the assisted living facility, and that showed that the charges for room and board were between $176 and $255 per day. She moved rooms, I think is why that had a variance in it. But the assistance with daily living was only $40 per day, and Medicaid management was $35 per day. So how this money is being categorized in the assisted living facility by their accountants is what's going to determine whether or not this person gets community Medicaid. On appeal, the ALJ says the income was too high and explained that the assisted living facilities are considered community-based services and such individuals are responsible for paying their own room and board. They take it up to the next level of administrative appeal, and I think the attorney had a little bit to vent about. They argue that the actual medical daily rate was the full room and board of $333 per day, and that the ALJ made the decision based on an erroneous view of what medical expenses are and on a fundamental misapprehension of how billing at an assisted living facility works. That would have been a good hearing to hear the attorney say that. However, the agency, as usual, affirms the ALJ's decision because there was no other evidence for the attorney's argument. The appellant then files an appeal up to the courts that says that money in the QIT shouldn't be counted as income, and that reliance on the $75 daily Medicaid rate is insufficient, and then made some other arguments as well. The argument around the money in the QIT I thought was pretty interesting, but it wasn't considered due to a lack of preserving that argument. But the court at that rate, at that level, was also unpersuaded that the medical costs of $75 per day were unsupported by credible evidence in the record, because there was evidence in the record, and it wasn't made arbitrary and capricious or unreasonable, because that's the only evidence that they had, because that's how the assisted living facilities accountants were classifying those charges. So accountants rule the world. This person doesn't get Medicaid because the room and board was highly weighted, whereas the medical services were undervalued, in my personal opinion. But the ALJ and the agency decisions were left undisturbed, and this person does not get any help with their assisted living bill. Okay, elder law news. The news is crazy right now. I'm only going to hit on a couple things. The new numbers came out. The figures were increased by 2.5% from 2024. Please sign up for Attorney Access. Get your basic membership, and you can get all of your state's numbers. I thought it was really interesting that the maximum home equity limit is over $1 million now. So that was way below that when I first started in elder law. Michigan has raised their individual resource allowance as of February 1st. This is following a trend that states are doing this. Again, the majority of states have the individual resource amount at 2,000. But Michigan has raised theirs to over $9,660, or $9,660. That 2,000 number had been the same since 1964. So hopefully that helps folks keep a little bit more resources when they go to apply for Medicaid to keep their quality of life a little bit higher. I'll just read this slide. Trump nominated Dr. Oz to run the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. RFK Jr., I think as we speak, his vote is on the Senate floor to run DHS. Dr. Oz, if you don't know who he was a surgeon and then a television talk show host. He ran for Senate out of Pennsylvania and lost in 2022. Shockingly, hasn't made many policy statements other than he loves privatization through Medicare Advantage plans and may have some conflicts of interest in some of his investments in those plans. He goes before the Senate Finance Committee, so he doesn't go before the full Senate. He'll go before the Senate Finance Committee for a confirmation hearing. From what I can tell, that hearing has yet to be scheduled. I'm assuming they're waiting to see what happens today, and then they'll get that schedule, and then he'll go through a hearing, and we might get some insight on how he wants to manage CMS. My assumption is, if we're looking at what the Republican House came up with for a budget, we're looking at a lot of cuts. So just be aware that we might get some insight during that committee meeting. And with that, we did it. Please sign up for Attorney Access if you like our resources. That is the hub to get these numbers and to get those resources. We have a free account you can sign up for. And if you want to subscribe and be able to access all of our on-demand education, please upgrade your subscription there at our Attorney Access Hub. One just quick highlight, if you're on this and you wanna learn Medicaid planning and you're not doing anything next week, we are doing a live event in New Orleans starting Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday for crisis planning, and we're coupling that with Atticus. We still have a couple seats available if you wanna sign up for that. That's our first live event that we've done like this with Kraus and teaming up with Atticus. So we'll be covering crisis planning. You can sign up for that as well on our website. Thank you so much for attending. Hopefully that is helpful. If you need the cases, they're in the agenda. You can read those. I thought they were the most interesting, and we'll see you next time. Thanks, everybody.